This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Gardening. Need we say more? Well, perhaps this much. Every time Green Thumb advisors Guinevere Higgins and David O'Neill stop by, our phone lines get to overflowing pretty darn quickly. Now, there's always the possibility this is the one time that won't happen, but why take the chance? For the live broadcast that's about to commence on this Monday, May 20th, our call-in number will be 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. So if you have a gardening challenge for David or Guinevere, why not get your fingers dialing right now? Maybe you've got a stump the experts type question, or even a hard-won gardening problem solution you'd be willing to share. Whatever it is, we'd love to add your voice to this Green Thumb edition of Insight, coming up right after the news.
Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. On this Monday afternoon, May 20th, 2013, we are taking calls on anything and everything to do with gardening. Now, if due to a wrinkle in the space-time continuum, you are listening to this on some other date in time, we would not be able to take your call. But if right now for you is a Monday in May, then we want to make sure that you know our phone number. 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember it in all numbers. It translates to 888-967-2825. Back with us in the Insight studio, our favorite Green Thumb advisors, Guinevere Higgins of Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest and David O'Neill from Radical Roots Community Farm. Happy May 20th to you both.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
So, in addition to our phone number, 888-967-2825, there is another option for getting a question to Dave and Guinevere. You can post to us on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we already have a couple posted here. The first one from Jason, who says, I would like to know if there are any recommendations for privacy hedges that will thrive but also max out at a relatively low height. We currently have a privacy hedge that grows at an extraordinarily fast pace, and it is difficult to keep up with it.
Well, that's always the case. Plant growth rates are totally subjective, and the nursery trade likes to say it's a, you know, it's a slow-growing plant, and it maxes out at 6 feet. That's what a lot of people want to hear. And if it likes its condition and it has a lot of sun, it might grow to 6 feet, then 8 feet, then 10 feet. So yeah, there's some management there in keeping it down. There are a lot of great cultivars that are dwarf, things like boxwoods. There's hundreds of different kinds of boxwoods. There's dwarf arborvitaes. Those two would be great evergreens. Rhododendrons would be good too. They're kind of
short.
So
does dwarf mean, David, that the gardening store is going to tell you it'll grow to 4 feet and it'll actually grow to 8?
Well, hopefully it'll grow to 4 feet and it'll kind of max out its expression at 4 feet, 4 to 6 feet. There's usually a range. But there's also a different perspective of thinking of that extra growth above what you want your privacy hedge to be at as great organic matter to be cut or coppiced at that height and used to build soil. Used in the compost
pile. I learned so
pile.
Much Latin when you guys are here. I'm guessing that's Latin. Coppice?
Coppice.
Really? Yeah. I don't think it's Latin.
No, it's Old English.
Yeah.
Really, that's how they managed
a
lot of their hardwoods. It was.
Okay, so spell it for us.
C-O-P-P-I-C-E.
And what coppice. Does it mean?
It's a form of cutting. Coppice is usually about waist height, and there's also pollarding, which is usually above head height, just above the browsing height for animals.
So and, after you coppice or pollard,
yeah.
Then you take it and you make it into mulch? Or?
What we do on the farm is we plant a lot of crops just for coppicing to get organic matter. The shrub layer is the most efficient converter of sunlight into organic matter, basically woody photosynthesis, you know, and it's capturing carbon and all that great stuff. And we'll take some of our shrub layers and just cut them at waist height and send them through the chipper shredder right into the compost pile or mulch around our fruit trees and just use that new woody organic matter to build garden soil.
Because some plants are incredibly effective at pulling up nutrients and minerals that are deep within the soil that you can't access readily or that your little vegetable crops certainly can't access. So if you can get the plant to do it for you and then compost or mulch with that material, as Dave's suggesting, then you get this added benefit of additional nutrition for your plants.
So Jason can look for dwarf boxwoods.
Sure.
But you both are saying he should be grateful for the opportunity to cut off the top of his hedges and use the material to enrich his soil.
Sure.
If you want to join the conversation, any question whatsoever about gardening, and we always love the stump the experts type if you think you've got one. 888-WMRA-TALK. First, we're going to Stanton. Brian, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Dave and or Guinevere, please.
My question is related to a type of fine fescue to grow actually in Middle Tennessee, south of Nashville, a dark green fine-bladed fescue, and what your recommendations are.
A vescue, did you say?
Yes.
You're talking to two people who don't, unfortunately, grow grass.
Yeah, I'm not a turf guy.
Not a turf gal. I don't have any good recommendations for you.
But you always know where people can go to find stuff out. At least you have in the few dozen times you guys have been here before. So where does somebody go to get expertise that you guys don't have when it comes to turf?
I would start with Extension. They have a lot of great publications and web links. Virginia Cooperative Extension is the statewide program run out of Virginia Tech or Virginia State University in Petersburg.
And Brian, you live in Tennessee?
I do live in Tennessee.
Somewhere near Nashville, did you say?
About 30 miles south of Nashville.
So I guess we're recommending then that you Google Tennessee Cooperative Extension. My experience is that most every state has some version of that.
Yes, I did use it when I lived in Virginia, so I'll look them up in Tennessee.
Well, thanks so much for the terrific question. Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you very much.
Let us know how it works out, because we want to find out. And by the way, if you get a chance to keep listening, I'm sure there are other people on the other side of their radios right now that have opinions or recommendations in response to your question. And if they can get through, we'll put them on the air and see what they have to recommend to you.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Thanks so much for calling. Next question here on Facebook, Guinevere Higgins and David O'Neill, comes from Jessica. Quote, I am wondering if you can recommend any sort of especially hardy houseplants. I must have whatever the opposite of a green thumb is. Would that perhaps be a red thumb? Is there something I can grow inside a pot in my home that might be able to survive despite me? End quote. I'm hoping we can answer her middle question there. Is the opposite of a green thumb a red thumb?
Is it black or brown?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, a brown thumb might be a good thing. I don't know. It's the color of soil.
A wilted yellow thumb?
Yeah, okay. Yellow. I would go with yellow.
Hardy houseplants.
Hardy houseplants. So, you know, I actually tend not to do very well with houseplants. I prefer the ones that grow in the ground, outdoors. I know. Well, it's, you know, it's not really gardening when it's inside in a pot. But I have managed to keep alive an aloe plant and an ancient meaning like 10 years old, jade plant that a good friend gave me years and years ago. You know, and it depends on the, you know, what's going on in your house. Oftentimes in the winter, indoors, it's incredibly hot and dry. So having a succulent plant like an aloe or a jade, which are very, very good at conserving moisture, can be really helpful because they're able to they have their own set of strategies for coping with lack of water in case that's not something that Jessica can keep up with. So I would go with one of them. But, you know, there's all kinds of houseplants that are really good at cleaning the air, which I think is fascinating. English ivy being one of the best and spider plants being one of the best. And I think that's really fascinating because, you know, in our modern age, we are surrounded by all kinds of things that off-gas all these toxic chemicals. So it's actually really critical to have a clean indoor air, and plants can help us do that.
How do they do that? Do they absorb the gas that's there and put out a healthier gas in response?
Well, you know, as we know, all plants clean the air, you know, by releasing oxygen. You know, some plants apparently are just better at taking in toxins and releasing good, clean air back.
David O'Neill, have I heard you say before that one of the biggest challenges for people who are having trouble with indoor plants is too much versus too little light?
Light is a, definitely a limiting factor when you're talking about growing plants who eat sunlight, right, through photosynthesis, indoors. There's often a limiting factor, a lack of light, or it's a very kind of partial light from one side. We grow, the only thing we really grow in our house is potted herbs, you know, on the kitchen windowsill. We've had basil all winter, and sometimes we have parsley and cilantro and all the pot herbs just right there. And we have full sun, and they still get leggy, meaning that they're reaching for the sun and they're kind of, a little disformed just because they're reaching to try to stretch out and grab that sunlight.
Other problem, Guinevere, too much water, not enough water, hard to tell for what kind of plant?
Well, again, it's another reason to have us to grow a succulent because air on the side, like if you forgot to water it for months and months on it, it would be okay. So, and you can err on the side of too little water with those plants and not worry about killing them. They don't seem to have any soil needs. You know, anytime you're growing something in a container, you know, you're responsible for providing all that plant's nutrition. It can't pull anything out of the ground, out of the soil. So it's really important to make sure that you've got a good growing medium. But again, for the succulents, it's like you could practically plant them in sand and they'd be fine.
Professional organic gardener Guinevere Higgins, as well as professional organic farmer Dave O'Neill, are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, 888-WMRA Talk, how to reach us by phone. Let's go next to Woodstock. Glenn, thanks for calling in. Your question, your comment, please.
Hey, I just wanted to bring up a couple of quick points. You previously had mentioned dwarf plants, and dwarf can mean a whole lot of different things. It's very misleading. Quite often, dwarf can also refer to leaf size, the distance between the petioles on the plants, the branching habit, and not necessarily the final height. I mean, an excellent example is dwarf Burford holly, which actually gets to 25, 30 feet tall eventually. Also on your an excellent house plant that needs next to no care is a good old Aspidistra, also known as cast iron plant. And it was called cast iron plant because it was even able to stand up to the conditions in Victoria-era saloons, especially next to the spittoons. It's quite an interesting thing.
That's great, Glenn. And those are all good points because the leaf size, the branching height, all those points can be expressed in different ways. And it can be really confusing in the nursery trade, especially when you're trying to pick out plants. I think really taking information about mature size with a grain of salt is important because people usually understate those things.
And a dwarf fruit tree could be 12 feet tall, and that's quite different from a dwarf boxwood.
Right.
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 If in my line of work, if people ask me, you know, how tall will a plant get, I'll say, well, how long you got?
Right.
So, Glenn, I think that begs the question, what is your line of work?
I design landscapes. So
great.
So I've got a little background in horticulture here.
Yeah.
Thanks for your suggestions.
Sure.
Thanks for the call, Glenn.
All right, thanks.
So we have an unusual situation here for the Dave and Guinevere appearance. All of a sudden, all of our phone lines are open. And I know because just a couple of minutes ago, all of the phone lines were full and apparently some people couldn't wait any longer. So they hung up or their cell phone disconnected. I know that while all those phone lines were full, there were a whole bunch of people trying to call in and got a busy signal. So if you there were one such person, we're going to go to the break right now. And this would be a great time to grab one of those open phone lines if you've got any kind of question or suggestion that has anything to do with growing stuff, digging in the dirt, making a better garden. 888-967-2825. We're going to be back in a bit more than 1 minute. And I think we have some special music coming up, too.
plants are on fire. All the plants are on fire. They have a secret life. They have a secret life. All the plants are on fire. They're looking for a wife. All their pots have turned to gold. All their leaves are almost old. All the plants are on fire. In my house in the rain. All the plants are on fire.
We have some exceptional producers here. One of them found that song by Ring Zero. All About Houseplants is its title. I don't know if that band talked to our listener, Jessica, before they put together that song, but some people can probably identify. Gardening specialist David O'Neill, co-owner of Radical Roots Community Farm in Keezeltown. Gardening specialist Guinevere Higgins, co-founder of the Charlottesville-based gardening consulting firm Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And we have this question from Angel, who says, I'm looking for an unusual plant. This is on our Facebook page. I'm looking for an unusual plant. It's called a husk or ground cherry. I found seeds for it, but would really like to find a plant to put in my garden this year. Any ideas where I might find one?
Well, Angel has indeed found a special, special plant. Husk tomatoes, ground cherries, Cape gooseberries. This plant has a ton of different names.
What is it?
It's a delicious. It's in the tomato family, but it grows more like a tomatillo. It's like a smaller tomatillo with a little paper husk. It's
a tomatillo.
A tomatillo, yeah. So it's a low growing, spreading plant.
I feel so ignorant whenever you guys show up.
Oh, you just need to get out to your Mexican restaurant more often.
Okay.
So tomatillos are delicious, wonderful in salsa, but ground cherries are sweet. They're like an extra sweet, almost tropical flavored cherry tomato, and they're fantastic. And I've found that when I grow them in my garden, they almost never make it into the kitchen, because when you're outside weeding or harvesting, you're just popping them in your mouth and they're so good. But I would say go ahead and plant those seeds, because ground cherries are incredibly fast growing. And once you get them established in your garden, what's kind of awesome about them is that they will self-seed. So the following year, next year, you'll find that you'll have little seedlings of ground cherries popping up all over your garden. You will never have to buy a ground cherry plant again. But what you do need to do is get the seed in the ground now, or started in a pot now. I've not seen them available in the nursery, and maybe Dave can create a niche market for himself and be the only supplier of ground cherries in the Harrisonburg and Charlottesville areas.
We'll grow them next year.
Great. I hope you will. They're so good.
But you think Angel will have no problem getting those
no
seeds
problem.
To grow
they are really
quickly.
Easy to start. And I would just say, don't waste any time. Get that seed in the ground, and you will have ground cherries this summer.
And it's not anything that you need to grow in a pot first and then transplant. You can just stick
She can it. If she wants, but she can also just stick it in the ground.
And now is a great time to plant pretty much your full selection
yes, it
of
is
garden
like,
vegetables.
It is on. And we've had all this rain.
And the soil is finally warming up. I mean, yes. It's been a cooler spring, but we're building up our degree days, and then the soil temperature, which is the critical point for a lot of plants, is finally warming up.
So let's talk about the space-time continuum here for a moment, because if somebody is in fact listening to this program live on the 20th of May, Monday, then it would have been 1 week previous where something unusual happened.
Yes, we had a frost on our farm on last Monday, May 13th. It was actually Tuesday morning early. It got down to 29 degrees, which is after our official last frost date, which is true 9 out of 10 years. Actually,
that's right.
In 2002, over 10 years ago, we had a 26-degree frost on May 20th.
And I have a good friend who lost 75% of her tomato plants on May 24th.
Oh.
Yeah, down in Scottsville, so a low-lying area. So, yeah, just when you think you're out of the woods.
Yeah. So officially now, you know, it should be in the clear for planting all those tender vegetable crops that wouldn't thrive if it got down below 32 degrees. So basil, peppers, cucumbers, eggplant, tomatoes, all those tender vegetables. It's a great time to get those in the garden now, because it's warm, the soil's warm, and we should be in the clear and not have any more cold nights. At Radical Roots Farm, we lost 200 tomato plants.
Oof.
We covered almost an acre of crops.
Wow.
With row cover, which is a white polyethylene sheet that is like a frost blanket. And we covered our peppers, eggplants, cucumbers.
But you still lost stuff.
Tomatoes were a little bit lower in the field. Mm. And we didn't have hoops holding that row cover up. And so where the row cover was actually, it was frozen and crispy. It was touching the plant.
Oh.
They didn't grow. They didn't make it through. So, but we have a big, organic plants nursery, and we have thousands of tomato plants for sale. And we just took some of our plant sale plants and planted them that same day. It was 80 degrees later, and we recovered within a few hours. So not too traumatic, but another good lesson about the last frost.
That's right, and this spring has been. I keep saying it's been unusual, but actually I think it's been pretty normal. And I think that's the unusual part.
Right.
It's been slow to warm up. It's been cool. We've had abundant rain. It's actually been, aside from the freaky frost that you had, Dave, it's been a really wonderful spring, and hopefully people have been enjoying it and outdoors planting their gardens, expanding their gardens, because now is really such a nice time to be out there.
Yeah.
So what's growing best this time of year? What do people need to know about right now?
I've got more greens and lettuce in my garden than I know what to do with. I'm like handing it out to people on the street practically. I should have brought some for you, Tom. I don't know what I was thinking.
I don't know what you were thinking.
all of our early sowings of lettuce. My carrots are about ready to harvest. The peas are just coming in. This is just such a wonderful time to be eating out of the garden. The garlic scapes, we just harvested our first garlic scapes over the weekend and cooked them up with
some
eggs.
What are those? Guinevere?
Well, garlic scapes are the flowering tops of hardneck garlic. So if you're growing hardneck garlic and you see that it's sending up this sort of curly-cued flower stalk with a big old bud on the end of it, you may think it looks really cool and pretty, and it does, but you really actually want to pull that sucker off. You want to snap it off at the plant, because you don't want that delicious, beautiful, perfect garlic bulb to put all of its energy into making a flower. You want it to save all of its energy in its bulb so you can be eating that garlic later on. So cut off those flower stalks. They're delicious. You can chop up the stem and saute them like you would anything. They're sweet and just faintly garlic flavored, and they are fantastic.
Garlic whistle pesto.
Yeah, there you go. You can make pesto out of them. I just like to eat, saute them with mushrooms. So good.
Somewhere, someone listening in right now. Well, you're the person who's had great success overcoming some kind of gardening challenge that the rest of us would be grateful to hear about. So if you're willing to tell us about it, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. Dave O'Neill, Guinevere Higgins, what are the biggest challenges people are facing in their gardens right now?
Mm. Right now, there's a lot of slug pressure because it's been so wet. We've seen a lot of damage where they've eaten the leaves of our greens crop, everything from Swiss chard to head lettuce and salad mix. We have lots of slug damage this year, which isn't too abnormal, but it really comes to a peak in a wet May, I think.
Absolutely. When it's warm and wet.
Right. Warm and wet. They're very active. I think it shouldn't be, I'm not looking forward to a bad pest pressure year. We had a decently cold winter. We get a lot of our overwintering pests that don't come back as strong after a cold winter, where they do come back very strong and vigorous after a very mild winter. So this winter was cold enough. I think we should be somewhat in the clear, not anticipating a really heavy pest pressure year.
Although I will say I've noticed quite an abundance of aphids of late. I've seen them on the peas. I've seen them in the lettuce. Also, at least in my own garden, a ton of ladybugs. So I'm hopeful that that's happening elsewhere as well. But people have asked me actually about what to do about aphids. And there's kind of two quick and easy approaches. One is just to smush them when you see them. And that's pretty easy and it's pretty effective. But if in so doing, just make sure you're not squishing your plants also. And the other is to spray safer soap, which essentially is palm olive dish soap. A few squirts of that in a spray bottle. So make a batch of soapy water and spray that. And that will typically do in your aphids, and it's pretty harmless to your crops.
One thing we do when we get aphids in the greenhouse is we'll do a release of beneficials.
Mm.
Those ladybugs, it's actually one of their number one foods.
Yes.
And so we order in beneficial insects. We get ladybugs and release them in our greenhouse.
Do you get the larvae or do you get the fully grown?
It's the larvae.
Okay, because yeah. they are the ones that are voracious.
I just got to ask, you order in. You go,
yes.
Hey, ladybugs, you're ordered over
it's,
here?
Well, it's kind of like fast food, right?
I was going to say, it sounds like carry up.
Well, it almost is. We get them from a website called Gardens Alive, and they're an organic resource distributor. And I think we get what's called the attack squad. Right.
And calling the troops.
Yeah, it's lace wings, ladybugs, maybe a few other heavy hitters in there for our beneficials, our predatories that eat those pests. And they send them out, I think, every 2 weeks, and we'll put them wherever our highest damage areas is. It's usually in a kind of controlled area in our high tunnel cold frames or in the greenhouse. It can be really, really effective.
And if people are unsure of what a ladybug or lady beetle larvae looks like, go Google an image, because they look nothing like their grown-up version. They're really cool looking, and if you see them, make sure you leave them alone, because they are probably eating their body weight in aphids every day.
Organic gardening advisor and operator of the Radical Roots Community Farm in Keesletown, David O'Neill, is one of our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. Sitting next to him, another organic gardening advisor, Guinevere Higgins. She runs Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, a gardening consulting firm based in Charlottesville. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. Phone number, 888-967-2825. Bill in Shenandoah, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
My question is, do we have an organic strategy for stink bugs on tomato plants?
There are a few. The stink bugs are pretty hard to deal with because there's no real known predators, although we do have some adaptations going on as we speak. we don't get a lot of economic damage from stink bugs at my farm at Radical Roots. They can be somewhat of a disease vector, spreading disease around, specifically in crops like cucumbers and squash. On tomatoes, when they're young, when we plant our first rotations early, we tend to cover them with row cover. That's kind of a general strategy. It's basically an exclusion method. The row cover helps the plants get established by creating a small microclimate like a greenhouse where it's warmer, and it keeps any pests out of that area. So that would be one way to get the plants started earlier and established where they're really healthy and strong. Tomatoes grow quick. We tend to stake ours up with 6-foot T-posts, so that row cover comes off after a couple weeks, and we're stringing them up. After that, I don't have any great strategies for stink bugs on tomatoes. That's kind of it. I mean, I've heard on fruit tree crops, people are using Surround, which is a kaolin clay, and it basically puts a coating, a clay coating, that protects the fruit crop from the stink bugs, so the stink bugs won't attack it or try to eat it.
And I've been really lucky too. I haven't had a big hit on the tomatoes in my own garden or my clients' gardens, and so knock on wood, hopefully it'll stay that way. But Tom, you've had folks on the show who know a whole lot more about stink bugs than me and Dave.
And I was going to get into a little bit of that, but I'm afraid that I ought to preface it by saying they don't yet offer a lot of hope. Bill, I'm curious if you can tell us about what your experience. We're hearing from Dave and from Guinevere that they haven't seen a lot of stink bugs bothering tomato plants yet, but I'm guessing you have?
Yes, I'm a backyard gardener, raised bed, do organics as much as possible, and I plant about 12 tomato plants a year, stake them very well and prune them and all that kind of good stuff, so I get nice, large, juicy tomatoes and cut them up and put them in spaghetti sauce and all sorts of things. And what hit me worse than anything else was the ripening fruit. The stink bugs would get in there when they're actually green, and they would chew just a little bit on it, suck a little bit of the stuff out of them, and then it would leave a wound on the tomato fruit, and then the rest of the tomato fruit would then waste and be no good. And I didn't find anything using the oils, trying to spray the plants and all that kind of good stuff, and some lime spray. I tried that. Basically just the organic things that I've had success in the past with, but it didn't seem to have any hope with the stink bugs, and I was hoping you guys come up with a viable strategy for the backyard gardener.
I've got it. It might be a little far out, and depends on how much time you have, but go to your local department store and get yourself some pantyhose. And you might find that it's time labor intensive, but if you love those tomatoes, and it sounds like you do, Bill, maybe tie them up in some, cover them in some pantyhose. Maybe that'll help. I know people have done that with their figs, and it's helped.
That's far out, Guinevere.
I know, it's pretty far out, but it's organic.
And you know, their little sucking or mouth parts are very small.
It's true.
So they would land, and my imagination would say that they would go right through the pantyhose.
Well, maybe if you have the time and inclination, maybe do it as a trial and let us know how it goes.
I will. I'll give it a try.
Okay.
Well, Bill, before you go away, one of the things that Guinevere was referring to is that it's been just about a month now since we had our latest session here on Virginia Insight with some of the scientists who are leading national research about dealing with stink bugs. And we'll probably get into some repetition of what they told us a month ago. But there are a couple of points that seem to me to relate to what's been said so far. One is that Tom Kuhar, who's one of the scientists at Virginia Tech involved in this effort, noted that the fruiting vegetables, as he calls them, are the ones that seem to be most popular for stink bugs. And he included among those sweet corn, tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, as well as beans and okra. Now, I don't know, maybe if you grew some beans and eggplant and peppers and didn't much care about them, that the stink bugs would go to them instead of your tomatoes. The other thing that these scientists told us is that they find one thing that does seem to help is some sort of fine wire mesh around a tree or around plants. That seems to discourage the stink bugs. So maybe that's along the lines of what Guinevere was saying. Is, you know, if you've got tomatoes that have pantyhose on them or some other covering, and your neighbor has tomatoes who don't, maybe the stink bugs will go for the easier meal.
The unfortunate thing is closest neighbor is about a mile away. Or maybe that's the luckiest thing. But thank you very much. And I did catch that program and heard those ideas already.
Okay.
I was looking for another strategy.
Well, good luck, Bill. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah, we do really want to know how the pantyhose works out for several reasons. The other thing, Bill, I'm going to mention, and thank you again for your call, for anybody who did not catch that discussion, that I found particularly fascinating is that some of the scientists working with Dr. Kuhar came up with this incredible invention that involves light, mirrors, and soapy water, and ends up inviting hundreds, if not thousands, of stink bugs all at once to move on to a new life in some other incarnation. So I'll
far
try
out
to,
disco, Tom.
Yes,
this is
I'll try to explain that a little bit better, but we're going to hit the break here in a second. And we have more music that I think is also right on topic and some more calls. Michael in New Hope, you will be our next call in just a couple of minutes.
Well, you can swat them like a fly, flick them like a flea, spray deodorant on them, I know that works for me. Drown them in a pool, flush them down the toilet, whack them with a book, put them in a pot and boil it. You think stink bugs stink? Wait till you smell me. I got a million stink bugs in my house and I'm about to have a cow. How can I get rid of them? I really don't know how.
The Stink Bug Song, a Kid Pan Alley production by Paul Reisler and Terry Allard, along with lyric writing help from Miss Fidner's fourth grade class at Brownsville Elementary School in Crozet, Virginia. And certainly right on topic, especially the part about I got a million of them house and how to get rid of them, I don't know how. So let's talk about this magic solution just before we get to Michael in New Hope that I don't know if it's too strong a term to call it a solution, but it was fascinating that one of the things that the scientists developed was taking something like a big turkey baster pan and putting some sort of reflective surface like a mirror on it. And at night, shining a light down onto the mirrored surface, and the turkey baster pan has been about half filled with soapy water. And anybody who's watched stink bugs in their house know that they're attracted to light. And if there's only one light in the house, that's where they'll go. Well, with the light, because of the mirror reflecting back up through the water, apparently they dive into the soapy water and commit suicide. And they have done this in structures overnight and found hundreds of stink bugs the next morning dead in the water, literally. And there's,
sounds great.
Yeah, there's some possibility that, you know, in the right circumstances, if the moon's not too bright, it might work outside in your garden as well. We have Guinevere Higgins and Dave O'Neill, gardening advisors extraordinaire, with us. Phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. But Michael in New Hope has been holding on for a while. So, Michael, your question or comment next, please.
Well, I don't have the stink bug issue. My great nemesis is the squash bug.
Oh.
Every year we get maybe one or two squash, and then everything liquefies. So
yeah.
I could use any good advice that you might have.
This is Guinevere's absolute favorite.
Michael, you just nailed my number one least favorite garden pest.
Your nemesis.
This is my nemesis. We have a shared nemesis, Michael. We should team up. So squash bugs stink. And actually, they're related to stink bugs. If you squash a squash bug, it smells like a stink bug.
I squashed a lot of them last year thinking I was getting ahead of the game. I still lost.
For every one you squash, there's probably hundreds that you don't squash. Well, the first thing I would encourage you to do is to look for the signs. So obviously, if you see an actual squash bug, then you know it's almost like game over. But if you can look on the undersides of the leaves, and squash bugs will go for squash, melons, cucumbers, anything in that cucurbit family. Although I've found that they tend to prefer the squash to the cucumbers, but that might not be true in your garden. If you look on the undersides of the leaves, oftentimes you'll see these little coppery colored eggs. They're about the shape of a football, but they're tiny. These little football looking things, and they're easily squashed with your fingers. So that's the first thing you can do. My preferred method of squash bug removal is to take out my little snip scissors and to cut them in half if I can get them. I've heard good things about planting dill near squash, that the dill can, it's very aromatic, it can act as a repellent for squash bugs. But they do overwinter in the soil. And as Dave mentioned earlier, I'll be really curious to see how we do this year with the squash bugs, since we actually had a relatively decent winter. I may have killed some of them off.
A couple good things to keep in mind, Michael, is crop rotation, which means not growing your squash in the same garden bed year after year, where the pest pressure can build up, but trying to rotate your crops in your garden over a four-year cycle. So that gives the soil a break. Also, we use a lot of floating row cover. It's an exclusion method. We basically cover up our squash rows with a long white sheet that's porous to rainwater and sunlight. And we'll grow them out all the way till harvest under that sheet. And that helps.
And there's no problem with the bees getting to the blossoms then?
That can be a problem. For cucumbers, we try to grow the self-fruitful ones. For squash, by the time they're ready to harvest, the plants are so big, they're pushing the row cover up, and plenty of bees and squash bugs are getting in there. But we typically get a good 4-week harvest out of our squash rotations using that method.
And I've advised my clients too, if they have a real, some people just seems they have terrible squash bugs, just take a year off from planting those cucurbits. And I know it stinks, but go buy Dave's squashes and cucumbers at the market, take a year off, and then try again the following year and just try to break that cycle, I think can be helpful too. Although that's sort of a last resort because, of course, you want to grow your own.
And first of all, get a pair of those scissors and go out and cut them all in half.
Yes, that feels good.
I'm sorry, Michael, go ahead.
It's not like my neighbors don't have a lot of squash to give me if I were to take
Well, there you
off.
Go. When you're in squash, you're in squash. So squash isn't hard to come by when it's in season.
Great. Hey, thank you so much.
Good
Michael,
luck, Michael.
Thank you for your call. We're going next to Linville. This is Lena. Thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for Dave O'Neill and or Guinevere Higgins, please, Lena.
Wonderful blessings to everyone that gardens and grows their food. My name is Lena. I've been a biodynamic gardener for about 25 years now. And we use a pest pepper spray for diverting the stink bugs and the squash bugs. And I'm currently working on a project with the woolly adelgid at an arboretum, too. And I have amazing results. And I would alert people to call the Josephine Porter Institute for Applied Biodynamics. I know that's a mouthful. It's in Woolvine, Virginia, but they could also just look up biodynamic agriculture and look up pest, P-E-S-T, pepper, P-E-P-P-E-R, sprays. And basically it is a ground-up solution of the dead bug itself, which you stir in water and then spray around your plants.
Lena, is this something people can make themselves, or are you suggesting that they order it online?
They should order it because it's actually a homeopathic dilution of about D8.
Okay.
Diluted quite small, this pepper of the bugs.
But you've found that you've had success with this disease?
Excellent success. And literally the whatever pest you have literally leaves the plants.
The biggest question or issue that we've heard so far in some areas, and the gentleman who called from Shenandoah, Bill, was for his tomatoes. Have you tried it on tomatoes?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that suggestion.
The only stink bugs we see now are, you know, sort of a couple inside every once in a while, which must be living in the walls. And they come out inside our house, but I really have no problem anymore. And they can look up biodynamic agriculture and see quite a bit of information on this, too. And what does happen is the pest actually leaves that plant and goes to another one. For the example, the woolly adelgids, they all left the eastern hemlocks and went to hostas.
Hmm.
And so it does not kill them, but it just deters them from being on your precious tomatoes.
Lena, thank you so very much for your call. So we've got just a few minutes left. 888-WMRA-TALK, the phone number, and all numbers 888-967-2825. Anything and everything about gardening we are open for. Guinevere Higgins, Dave O'Neill, our expert guests. I know that there are other topics that you guys want to talk about, and one of them probably has something to do with an open house that in the time continuum we are discussing would be appearing on a Saturday, last Saturday in May?
Yeah, that's right, May 25th. Where Radical Roots Farm is hosting our annual open house farm tour and plant sale from 10 to 4 o'clock. There will be a plant sale all day. There'll be a tour of our farm where you can come and see some of the techniques we're describing about pest exclusion and see my 500 tomato plants that got replanted. The tour is at 2:30 on May 25th, and the farm is open all day from 10 to 4. And be great to have fellow gardeners to come look around and see how we're growing some of our crops. We're a certified organic farm right here in the Shenandoah Valley outside of Harrisonburg.
And you do not charge admission.
There's no admission.
People can buy stuff.
Please bring your wallet to buy some plants for your garden. But it's a free tour at 2:30, and it's kid-friendly, not dog-friendly. So bring the family.
And I've got two announcements, but they're actually not garden-related. They're eating-related. which is the corollary to gardening, right? I mean, why would you bother gardening if you didn't like to eat? As you've mentioned before in previous shows, Tom, I've been involved with an organization called City Schoolyard Garden, and we have two really fun and delicious fundraising events coming up.
And just in case somebody has never heard you say it before,
City Schoolyard Garden
City Schoolyard Garden.
Thanks, Tom.
She gets excited.
I do get so excited. So it's a wonderful program in Charlottesville. We do educational gardens in Charlottesville Public Schools. We're in every single elementary school and the middle school in Charlottesville. But we are a nonprofit and we are in need of community support. So we've partnered with Petit Pois, which is one of our wonderful restaurants in the downtown mall. And they have generously offered to give a portion of their proceeds every Tuesday for lunch and dinner. So if you're hungry on a Tuesday, go eat at Petit Pois.
In Charlottesville
in the downtown mall. And a portion of your meal will directly benefit school kids in Charlottesville learning all kinds of wonderful things in their school's garden. The other event is on June 16th. It's a Sunday, and which happens to be Father's Day. So I can't think of a nicer activity to do with your dad than to bring him to Hill and Holler's June meal. Hill and Holler is a wonderful outdoor, locally sourced meal experience on a local farm. And good friend Tracy Love organizes these dinners, and they always benefit a local food or farming-related nonprofit. So if you want to learn more about these awesome events, you can visit the Facebook page for City Schoolyard Garden. Just search for us on Facebook. For Hill and Holler, you can learn more about that event at hillandholler.org. Lots of great things to eat and good work to support.
Sounds tasty.
We've had several people who've been online briefly with us, and then they were traveling, either went out of cell phone range or whatever it was that happened. But of these calls, there is a note that I had for one of them, and I didn't get a name, so I don't know if it was a him or a her. But this person specifically was hoping that either or both of you could help offer some advice about why their aloe keeps wilting.
Well, you know, I'm not very good with houseplants, and my aloe doesn't wilt. So I don't know that I'm going to be very helpful in answering this question. But maybe try potting it up in a bigger pot with some adding a little compost in there and seeing if that doesn't help the situation.
We have aloe in our house, and it's going gangbusters.
Yeah.
And we don't ever touch it. I don't know.
The only
thing we do is you know, separate little aloe babies and give them to our friends. It does get good light where it is. And I think my wife waters it once in a while. I know
yeah.
I don't.
Maybe don't water it. That might be a problem because aloe actually, you know, it's just designed to function with low water. So if it gets too much, it might end up with some kind of a fungal issue or some other kind of a disease.
This one of those things that is possibly related to the light issue that you were talking about before, David?
Could be. Yeah. I mean, I think they need, I would imagine they need a good amount of indirect or direct, as much sunlight as you can get to be inside. That's a common problem with indoor houseplants.
Okay. So I've been trying to access our Facebook page because I got an alert that there was somebody here trying to get a question to us, and I apologize for typing and trying to pay attention to you guys all at the same time. There's so many posts here from Lillian that I'm having trouble figuring out which the first one was. How many hours of sunlight does a veggie garden need? My backyard is partly shaded. Okay. That seems to be the essence of Lillian's question.
We can handle that one.
Yeah, that's a very common problem.
Very common.
In suburbia, there's lots of tall trees, there's lots of buildings, and plants need light. So lots of people have gardens, and their garden plants aren't getting to full expression because they're struggling for light. If you have less than 6 hours of direct sunlight, it's going to be hard to grow fruiting crops like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, squash. Those fruiting crops need minimum 6 hours of sunlight.
Their fruit production is a function of how much sun they get.
Yes.
So the more sun...
They are happy in full sun.
Yes.
12 hours a day.
Yes.
And
bring it on.
Their minimum is going to be 6 hours of sunlight. If you have less than 6 hours, you might want to focus more on greens. They can grow better, like lettuce greens and salad mix and cooking greens like kale and chard. All of those can grow okay with less than 6 hours of sun. They still would grow best with 4 hours of direct sun. So that's kind of some benchmark numbers mm-hmm. for hours of sunlight that you want to get. Basically, you want to put your vegetable garden in the sunniest place you can. And a lot of times for people, that's in their front yard.
Right, or it's in their driveway.
It's in their
even
driveway.
Better. Get rid of your car and plant a garden.
Yeah, dig it up or go container or just go wild. You know, front yard garden. That's okay.
I know, what a radical idea. Of course you would like that. You're the Radical Roots.
Radical Roots, we love it. You know, turn all of suburbia front yards into food producing gardens.
Needs that fescue? No more fescue.
My apologies for the people who all of a sudden just are calling in because we've got just seconds left, so we won't be able to take any more calls on air. We'll see if we might be able to get to you quickly after the show ends. But let me mention just briefly the other good news that we heard potentially about stink bugs. When we talked to these scientists a month ago, is that there seem to be predators developing a taste for them here in the U.S. They now find some spiders and some birds and some chickens are developing a taste for stink bugs. So maybe you guys can report back to us about that.
I did last fall see a praying mantis going to town on a stink bug.
There you go.
Our guests have been Guinevere Higgins, professional gardening advisor and owner of Charlottesville-based consulting firm Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, as well as Dave O'Neill, organic farming specialist and co-owner of the Radical Roots Committee Farm in Kieseltown. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. It was fun.
We'll wait a couple months. Get you back.
Great.
Sounds good.
Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.